On the Ideas Network, our guest this hour spends 90% of his time writing about politics, but we're going to start the hour with Frank Bruni talking about meatloaf, of course. Today's column is Devin Nunes is dangerous, and we'll be talking about him during the course of the hour. Frank Bruni also wrote, well, he's written a lot of great columns, The Dangerous Safety of College. He looks at the recent melee at Middlebury College where students shouted down and chased away a controversial social scientist. He believes that, you know, campuses need to be open to all kinds of thought. And by shouting down this speaker, the students have done themselves a terrible disservice. We will be talking about that. But we're going to start the hour with meatloaf. Frank Bruni is our guest, and Frank has a brand new book, and I believe it is his first cookbook. He, of course, was the restaurant critic for a number of years for the New York Times. But the latest book is A Meatloaf in Every Oven, Two Chatty Cooks, One Iconic Dish, is the subtitle. And it was co-written with a friend of his who covers politics as well for the New York Times, but also likes food. Frank has been an op-ed columnist for the Times since 2011, joined the paper in 95. He's been a White House correspondent, the chief restaurant critic. His columns appear every Sunday and Wednesday, so there's one today. And he writes about all kinds of topics, a number of topics deal with American politics. He writes about higher education frequently, popular culture, gay rights, and he is our guest. The first hour of today's program, we'll be welcoming phone calls for Frank. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, where we have all kinds of pictures of rescue dogs after Monday's show. And if you love dogs, I would ask you to go to the page because some of the pictures are absolutely splendid. And we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Frank. Hi, Frank. Are you there? Oh, dear. We're not set up here. Frank, can you hear me? Well, I'm not sure what's wrong here. So we'll try and get Frank in a moment. He's also written, we're going to talk about meatloaf at the top of the show. I know he's there in studio. We're just having a hard time getting him on the air here. But he wrote this very interesting, we want to spend some time about the column that he wrote on the dangerous safety of college. So that will be coming up during this hour as well. Frank, can you hear me now? No, I can't. Hour two of our program today, we will be looking at President Trump's executive order, rolling back efforts, some would say, to combat climate change in the United States. Emily Holden will be joining us. Emily is a reporter at E&E News. It's an organization focusing on energy and the environment. The executive order dismantles President Obama's core climate change policies. He had coal miners gathered around him and penned the order that would shelve clean power plant mandates. We'll be looking at that, and that should be an interesting conversation as well. Frank, can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, Frank, it's good to hear you. Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. I could hear you. I could hear you all along, and I was trying to chat. Sorry about that.
That's okay. You were feeling for me. What in the world is she going to do? I can't believe I'm talking to you about meatloaf at the top of the show, but why not? If it can help heal the country, Frank, let's do it, right?
Well, you know, I mean, as it turns out, we're having something of a meatloaf moment, and Jennifer, my co-author, and I never would have guessed that, but about a couple weeks after our book was out, there was that news story about Chris Christie going to the White House and Donald Trump insisting that he eat the meatloaf for lunch. So so we somehow caught a meatloaf wave that we didn't even know was coming.
I used to love Meatloaf Tuesdays, I think it was, when I was growing up. My mom was a great cook, and she could make a mean meatloaf, and I just loved it. I still love meatloaf.
Well, I still love meatloaf, and that's more remarkable, Kathleen, because I spent 2 years cooking almost nothing but meatloaf as we were developing the recipes. So the fact that I still make it for dinner parties, so obviously I've got some sort of meatloaf pathology, you know?
Yeah, we'll have to put your recipe on our Facebook page. You also
my mother's recipe is the one that leads off the book, and you said you loved your mother's meatloaf. I loved my mother's meatloaf too, and I think you can pretty much divide the world into two camps of people. People who could not stand or abide their mother's meatloaves, and people who yearned for them. And I'm in the yearning camp.
Yeah, I'm with you. I am with you. I had chicken for lunch, but man, I was thinking about meatloaf. Maybe tomorrow.
You know, you could split the difference and have a chicken meatloaf. We've got several of them in the book.
I never even thought of that, and never have I had such a dish. Would it be tasty, Frank?
We actually have, Kathleen, I'm going to change your world. You're going to thank me. You're going to write me in a couple of weeks, and you're going to say, you have improved my life like few people have. We actually have a buffalo chicken meatloaf.
Whoa.
That when you eat it, if you closed your eyes, you could believe you were eating a buffalo chicken wing dredged in blue cheese.
Oh, my gosh. And it's probably pretty good for you, right?
I think the blue cheese is present in such abundance in this meatloaf that it depends. I mean, it depends on your nutritional aspirations and values.
So you invited some politicians to contribute. You have Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Susan Collins, and Paul Ryan.
Yes.
And it's interesting, the recipes kind of reflect their politics in some ways, or who they are as people.
You know, it's really fascinating. It started out, Jennifer Steinhauer, my co-author, is our chief congressional correspondent. She covers Congress. And so as she was interviewing people over recent years and we were doing this book, when they would be chatting, she would, you know, say, you know, what are you up to in your life? Here's what I'm up to in my life. And Susan Collins said, I would love to share my meatloaf with you. Would you be interested? And so Jennifer said, sure. And so we had Susan Collins, as she's obviously the Republican senator from Maine, a very moderate centrist senator. So we had her recipe, and we thought that was the end of it. And then one day Jennifer went to do, you know, one of her periodic interviews with Paul Ryan. And he kind of said, what are you up to, et cetera. They got to talking about meatloaf. And he said, may I give you my venison meatloaf recipe? So at this point we realized we had a House Republican and a Senate Republican, and we should go get Democrats from the House and Senate, and we should have a bipartisan meatloaf chapter.
Of course.
And that's what we did.
You know, you also, I don't know, we looked for this on YouTube. You also, I know you were talking about this Martha Stewart appearance, Donald Trump and Melania Trump, who were making meatloaf on her show.
It is one of the most surreal things you will ever see. And so I would encourage you and your viewers to go on YouTube and search Melania and Martha Stewart and Donald Trump and meatloaf.
Okay.
And you should find your way to a clip that I think is from 2004, sometime around then. And Donald is sharing his mother's meatloaf recipe with the world. And Melania's there helping to make it. And I don't want to ruin it for you, but her manner of dress is not what you associate with the drudgery of meatloaf cookery. And neither she nor Donald look like they really have ever had much acquaintance with a spatula or, for that matter, any other kitchen utensil. So it's an unintentionally comedic interlude on Martha's show that I think makes for very intriguing viewing.
Is Melania wearing sensible shoes or not?
You can't see her shoes, but you can see her, and I never say this word correctly, her décolletage, is that right?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Which, again, is not something I associate with the making of meatloaf, but, you know, you live and you learn.
I guess so. Oh, meatloaf, meatloaf. And the president likes meatloaf, too, right?
He does. Now, we didn't know this when we set out on the book because we didn't know that Donald Trump would be our president. I don't think anybody knew that until November 9th. Well, I mean, a couple people. But, yeah, it turns out he is a big meatloaf fan. He's got not run-of-the-mill food tastes. I wrote a whole column about the food snob's reaction to him ordering his steak well done and then slathering it with ketchup. I actually wrote in defense of that because I think we all have food quirks if we're honest.
Yeah, I'm sure we do. Well, I will try some of the recipes, and congratulations on a cookbook on meatloaf.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Do you mind if we move on to politics? We can go back to meatloaf. I'm sure we'll get calls on meatloaf.
I am a meatloaf evangelist like few others in the world, but even I run out of things about meatloaf to say. So let's move on to politics.
All right, let's move on to Devin. How do you pronounce his name? Is it Nunes or is it Nunez? Do you know? I hear it both ways.
You know, I hear it both ways, and so I'm confused. And one of the reasons why I write and don't do TV is because I spell really well, but I pronounce horribly. Mm. So I don't want to be the ultimate source on that because I'm going to get it wrong. But it's N-U-N-E-S. We can agree on how it's spelled.
Yeah. Well, we can use it both ways then. Why hasn't Paul Ryan, you ask in your column today, kept a closer watch on him? He's just gone kind of wacky here with his trips to the White House in the middle of the night and really a disintegration of the whole House Intelligence Committee on a very important investigation.
Yeah, no, and that committee, I think, in the eyes of a great many people, has lost all credibility, integrity, and that's a big problem, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens next. I think Paul Ryan has had a lot on his plate, you know, not to go back to food metaphors, but, you know, I mean, while all this has been happening, it was happening at the same time as his attempt to get people behind his repeal and replace alternative to Trump, to Obamacare. And so I think he's got so many balls in the air and so many battles to fight that this one, what was happening with the House Intelligence Committee, is probably not something he's had much time for.
Mm-hmm. And yet it's getting, if you watch certain news channels, it's getting a huge amount of coverage.
It is, because it strikes to something very important. You know, this question, and maybe we'll find out at the end of the day that there's nothing there. But the fact that there have been enough little bits and pieces to have people asking the question of whether Russia meddled in this election in collaboration with anybody associated with Donald Trump, that's a big, important question.
Right.
And so the fact that one of the committees investigating this, that's entrusted with investigating this, is a place of so much discord, of such odd behavior by its chairman. I mean, that's a big story, and it's odd to me that only now do Republican leaders seem to understand how big that story is and how badly they've mucked things up in that regard.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Nunes is so deep in the tank for Trump that he needs scuba gear in today's column. What makes you write that?
Well, if you go back to those ridiculous tweets, that one morning that Donald Trump began tweeting about how Obama had tapped his wires, you know, and was even going, saying, you know, he's either a sick man or a bad man or whatever. These were many tweets. This wasn't one particular tweet. It went on for a while. Almost immediately, from both sides of the aisle, people said, you know, we can't support those sorts of wild accusations. He can't just say that without any proof. There was something close to bipartisan censure for Trump. And if you go back then, Devin Nunes was saying, oh, we should not attack the president for tweeting, as if the issue was the medium that he'd used to render his complaint, when really the issue was making this complaint without any proof whatsoever, and it's quite an incendiary complaint. So, and then you move forward from there, and at many different junctures, Devin Nunes made a point of saying that thing which would exonerate Donald Trump, that thing which would divert attention from Donald Trump. You know, the committee held a hearing. James Comey came in. He confirmed that the FBI was looking into all of this, and he confirmed that in public for the first time. And what was he asked about by the committee chairman? But he was asked about why there were so many leaks in government. It was this very assiduous attempt to change the subject. And there's only one reason you'd want to change the subject and try to do it that forcefully, and that's to move the spotlight away from the president's very suspect actions and his behavior in terms of leveling this wild accusation. So it seems to me that he has consistently tried to protect the president, and that says to me he's in the tank pretty deep, and that's why I'd like to give him a breathing tank and a mask and all of that a scuba diver has.
Do you think the Senate will do a better job of investigating? At least they'll be having an investigation?
I do, because by tradition the Senate tends to be the chamber of more decorum. And I also think now the Senate has seen the reaction to the way the House has handled this. They understand that they've got a sort of a bit of purchase and traction here. But I think they also understand that if they followed the House's lead and behaved in a way that didn't inspire much faith in people, I think they understand the stakes.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on. We'll get back to Meatloaf and to the House investigation. But let's move on to the health care. You wrote an interesting piece last week when it all fell apart. You know, it is phenomenal. The Republicans had a lot of years to fashion something, a lot of years, to fashion something that would be acceptable to members of their party and to the American public. And it was quite astounding to see it all go down, wasn't it?
It was absolutely astounding to see it go down because, as you said, Obamacare was passed 7 years years ago. And in fact, they made a point of having this vote in a very theatrical way on the seventh anniversary, on the 7-year anniversary. For all of that time, from the very beginning, Republicans were lambasting Obamacare. They were vowing that if they ever had the chance, they would undo it. That morphed into they're going to have something better for people instead of it. But a lot of time went by, and one would have assumed that during that time, there were a lot of smart Republicans sitting around thinking, and here's exactly how we'll do it. Here's the legislative path by which we'll do it. Here's the way we'll reorganize the system. And then the bill came out, and it was terrible in so many different ways. I mean, more than 20 million Americans were going to lose coverage, according to the CBO. It was going to make things very expensive for a lot more people. There was a tax cut for wealthy people involved in it. I don't think even the people who were voting for that bill really thought it was a great piece of legislation. So you have to ask yourself, what was happening in those 7 years, other than the political theater of saying that Obamacare was this peerless scourge upon the land? It seemed like nothing substantive was really happening, because after 7 years, they could neither produce a bill that made much sense or had much appeal, nor could they rally the troops behind it, in part because they hadn't crafted something that took all of those sensibilities into account.
So, Frank, do you think that it means now that the president will reach out to Democrats? Democrats will welcome such an overture on the part of the president, and they'll work together to fix Obamacare or not?
I don't know about Obamacare. I do think there are going to be upcoming situations. Infrastructure is one. When the president will reach out to Democrats if he thinks he can find votes there. And I think one of the interesting stories we're going to all be watching and chronicling in the coming weeks and months is what Democrats do about that. Democrats have a base that hates Donald Trump passionately. Nothing he's done since he stepped foot in the Oval Office has changed that. If anything, it's amplified that. And yet they are there to govern. They are there to make things happen that would improve the lives of their constituents. And if Donald Trump and his administration and Republican leaders in the Senate and House put something before Democrats that actually feels like sensible, prudent legislation, there's a real dilemma there. Do you vote no just to thwart Donald Trump? And you would say as you did so, hey, Republicans did this for years with Obama. You know, they had their minds made up to a no before anything came in front of them. Or do you take a kind of bigger, more high-minded path and say, wait, this particular thing I actually think is better than the status quo, so maybe I should vote for it? It's going to be a really tough call, because they don't want, in an overarching way, to support a president whom they believe with good reason is not good for America. But at the same time, if everyone is constantly situationally petty and small-minded and partisan, I don't know how we ever get past the kind of partisanship and polarization that's been crippling this country for a decade or more now.
Well, I think it's interesting on the infrastructure front that if he went ahead with that, he would make a lot of people who voted for him very happy. It would be a bill, you would think, that Democrats would embrace pretty enthusiastically, but the problems he may have may be with some Republicans.
Well, first of all, it depends on what's in that infrastructure bill. So there are questions to date about how much of it would represent government spending and how much of it would be, various things that were meant to spur private investment. And if the things that were meant to spur private investment ended up looking like corporate welfare, corporate giveaways, that's something Democrats could have a big problem with, and rightly so. But you are right. To date, some of the staunchest opponents of big infrastructure spending are those very same Freedom Caucus people. Although I think it's even bigger than the Freedom Caucus in this case. But, you know, that same sort of small government pushback at any sort of plan of the government that seems too ambitious. So I think with this one, there are potential problems on both sides of the aisle, and the devil is in the details of the actual infrastructure legislation.
We welcome phone calls for Frank Bruni. We're talking about Meatloaf, and we're talking about Devin Nunes, and we're talking about infrastructure. And I want to spend a little more time, too, because I know Frank has talked a lot about how hard it is. You can find common ground perhaps in Meatloaf, but finding common ground in other areas where we really need it when it comes to health care and safety of our country and how to get good-paying, family-supporting jobs for people. He says that the political divide, that we don't have a country of people across the political divide who can have sane, measured conversations. He worries about our inability to find common ground in places where it really shouldn't be that hard to find. We're living in those times. But what do you make of what he said about meatloaf? That would be okay. We can talk about meatloaf. What do you make of Devin Nunes? I'm going to give him both pronunciations during this hour. What he in the world he's doing. Are you disappointed that the House Intelligence Committee investigation seems to be kaput at this point? Do you expect more from the Senate? Do you think Paul Ryan should get rid of Nunes? Do you think he should step aside? What do you make of this Russia story? It keeps getting larger and larger. Now Jared Kushner meeting with this guy from this Russian bank where they had spies, and what was that all about? It just an ever-widening kind of web with not very many answers. And we also want to talk, Frank wrote a very interesting piece, Dangerous Safety at College, on March 11th, in which he looked at what happened at Middlebury College, where students shouted down and actually wasn't able to speak, Charles Murray. And what does it mean when that happens, when people are not allowed to speak, when speech you may not like is something that keeps a person from being able to give a speech that you may not like. He believes that, we have to hear all points of view in order to learn how to speak back. He worries that the groves, he writes, of academe are better at pumping their denizens full of an easy, intoxicating fervor than at preparing them for constructive engagement in a society that won't echo their convictions the way their campuses do. So we'll talk about that as we continue. Donald Trump's health care fiasco last week, we can talk about that. Here's how you reach the conversation. It's all on the table. If meatloaf is on the... Oh, I wish meatloaf were on the table tonight. If meatloaf is on the table, then everything is on the table. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll dig up that Donald Trump, Melania Trump appearance on Martha Stewart and put it up there during the course of the afternoon. And Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Frank has been an op-ed columnist for the New York Times since 2011. He has a column today. He appears on Wednesdays and Sundays. And he also has a new cookbook, A Meatloaf in Every Oven. And it is about meatloaf. It's meatloaf recipes. This is the Ideas Network. Frank Bruni is our guest this hour. Let's go to Karen in Appleton. Hello, Karen.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a comment and a question regarding health care. I believe the Republicans never came up with an idea on how to replace health care because I truly believe they just wanted to appeal it or repeal it. They didn't want to replace it. So my question is, what are the chances that the Republicans come back from this defeat and basically just repeal Obamacare and don't do any replace?
Frank.
I don't think that's going to happen because for the same reasons why they didn't start out there. I think you're right that a lot of Republicans were much more interested or solely interested in repealing and not replacing. They love health savings accounts and other methods of insuring, or not quite insuring people, but of trying to kind of spur medical care. I don't think they started out with just repeal and not replace because of how deeply the roots of Obamacare have planted themselves in American life. And I think that reality doesn't change now that they weren't able to pass the legislation they tried to last week. I think that regardless of their ideological qualms with Obamacare, too many Republicans come from too many districts and states in which people have come to depend on Obamacare. And they know that if they just get rid of it and there is nothing in its wake and in its stead, that could be political suicide. So I don't see that happening. Mm.
Thanks to the call. Julie on Facebook, Frank writes this, only Gorgonzola could perhaps rescue meatloaf. What do you think?
Oh, sorry. I didn't know if that was a question.
No, what do you think of her comment? Gorgonzola.
Well,
I never.
Well, I think that she needs to try some of the meatloaves in our book that have feta. Feta does a pretty good job of rescuing
feta.
Meatloaf.
Okay.
Ricotta does a pretty good job of rescuing meatloaf. But if she or he, was it a she or he? I'm sorry, I can't remember.
She, Julie.
If the, Yeah, if Julie truly believes that only blue cheese, gorgonzola or another kind of blue cheese, can rescue meatloaf, I would like her to know there are at least two and I believe three recipes in the book that use blue cheese. So there are some meatloaves that by her definition have been rescued, salvaged, redeemed, born again in a meatloaf in every oven.
Thanks, Julie, for your message. Karen, thanks for the call. Sam in Brookfield is next. Hi, Sam.
Hi.
Hi.
I just had a question for your guest. With the current bill that just failed, and he just said that he doesn't think that they'll be coming up with just a repeal bill in the Congress, but does he see the executive branch actively trying to sabotage the current healthcare markets and Obamacare as it is right now? That's it.
There are a lot of people concerned about that. There are a few things that have happened that suggest that could be in the works. I don't want to speculate on that, and I don't want to assume the worst. But it is a scenario that, especially when you hear the president say, okay, well, fine, now we're just going to watch Obamacare explode, and then the Democrats are going to come, he didn't say crawling back, but that was sort of the gist of his remarks, begging for some sort of legislation. It does make you worry. That there is very little investment, and in fact quite the opposite, in Obamacare's success or even its kind of functioning at the executive level. And there are things that can happen at the executive level that can undermine Obamacare's continued, people debate whether it's success or whatever, but can impede it functioning even as smoothly or not as it has done to date. So I think it's a subject of concern, but I don't want to render a prediction on that one.
Let's move into an area we could spend the whole hour on this. Your column you wrote on March 11, Frank, Dangerous Safety of College. Charles Murray was to speak at Middlebury College. Students wouldn't let him. They were yelling at him, big commotion. And you talk about a dangerous ideological conformity in too much of higher education. Why was this particularly upsetting to you? And is there a point where you shouldn't cross the line when you do invite a speaker? Somebody might be just too untruthful, too sensational, that it's not worth the while of the campus to have him or her speak.
Yeah, there's definitely a line that could be crossed. And part of the, I mean, this is, one thing that makes this a very tough issue is nobody's going to draw that line in the same place. And that line you can't come up with some sort of scientific formula for what that line is. It's one of those things that's in the eye of the beholder. And that makes this a very tough thing to struggle with. You certainly wouldn't invite somebody from the Ku Klux Klan to come and evangelize for the Klan on campus. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty clear one. But there's a lot of areas that are gray to people. What upsets me about what happened at Middlebury, it wasn't so much, I mean, it wasn't the fact of the protest. It was the actual kind of execution of the protest. You had people making sure that Charles Murray could not say a word, right? So they flooded the auditorium where he was supposed to speak. And now let's back up for a second and remind people of what the situation here was. Charles Murray wasn't simply given a microphone and told to say whatever he wanted to. Because they understood that he was coming from a place in the political spectrum that wasn't where many of the students exist, they made a point of appointing, of recruiting, of having a liberal professor who was going to be there to question Charles Murray on stage. Charles Murray was going to be available to take questions from students. So this was set up in a manner where he was agreeing to be contradicted, yes, to be challenged, you know, all those sorts of things. Even so, you had students flood that lecture hall, that auditorium, and not merely kind of stand up and turn their backs to him in protest, which even that might have been okay, but they shouted him down so that he could not say a word. When he and the professor then moved to a room where they could sort of, where on a camera, like through a kind of video and audio feed, they could have their talk and people could hear it, although not see him. A group of, no one's exactly sure of the exact composition of how many of them were students and how many were outside agitators, but a robust group of people went from the auditorium in search of where they were and were banging on windows and pulling fire alarms to try to disrupt them from having this conversation, even in this room. So there was a silencing that went on that I think went beyond the bounds of acceptable protest and ignored the fact that he was there on campus to engage in something of a debate, an spirited exchange of ideas, not simply to proselytize. It upsets me so much, Kathleen, because universities, schools in general, are places where you are supposed to have your theories tested, your presumptions challenged, your perspectives also challenged. And what all of this suggests is that too many students simply want to hear echoed back at them what they already believe, and that too many students indeed get to construct that sort of coddled cocoon for themselves on campuses, and that's antithetical to the whole mission of education. Mm.
Probably a reflection, though, isn't it, Frank, of where the country is? We all are listening to people who reinforce what we believe.
It to me, is perhaps the biggest problem in America today in terms of our political debate, because you are absolutely right. We have all this technology, you know, the internet, the cloud, et cetera. And the kind of transcendent irony is those things, if we wanted to use them so, could speed us to a greater wealth and diversity of information than we've ever encountered before. I mean, we certainly never had a means to get new facts, new figures, new ideas that was this fleet. But what people use this technology for is to curate their news feeds, their information, so that they're marinating in the same thing over and over again ad infinitum. And so people have this illusion that they're very well informed because they have 12 different websites, blogs bookmarked, and they follow 500 people on Twitter and another 1,000 on Facebook or whatever. But if they really look carefully, most people are following anagrams of the other things they're following. They're hearing the same thing over and over again. They're not really being exposed to a diversity of information. They're just being exposed to the same note again and again and again. It's very, you know, it's one note, it's monochromatic, and it impedes people from being able to talk to anyone on the other side, to entertain the thought that there might be some wisdom on the other side, to just kind of learn how to engage with the other side and see the world from a different viewpoint. I think it's a big driver of our partisanship and our polarization, the way we consume news and information today, and what that news landscape looks like.
So, Frank, how do we change that?
That's something that the change can't come from the government, because that would look like censorship, you know, and we certainly want the liberty to read what we choose to read and, you know, consume the information we want to consume. I think it has to come from schools. It has come from schools that are behaving well. Middlebury, actually, in the wake of all this, and even in the build up to this, behaved pretty well. It was just that something about that environment and something about the environments that students had come from to go to Middlebury led them to believe that was an appropriate way to behave. But I think each of us has a responsibility when you are putting together when you're constructing your Twitter universe. Who am I going to follow? When you are on the internet consuming information, when you're flipping the cable, you know, dial or using a remote control, I think all of us need to pause and say, am I simply constructing echo chambers for myself? And where does that lead? Or might I take a few steps to diversify what's happening in my world? I'm a big fan of sites that aggregate stuff from different points of the political spectrum. Mm. I'm a big fan of the website, and I'm happy to mention it because I'd like more people to look at it, realclearpolitics.com. Mm-hmm. What I love about realclearpolitics.com, it's essentially an aggregator, a curator. But if you go to its twice a day, it gives you a whole bunch of links. Those links come from every single point across the breadth of the political spectrum. And so if you just read those, you would have a very, very good idea of what a diversity of Americans think and feel about things and why. And you might even find that your own position or your own stridency on a given issue, you might find you don't believe that much anymore. You might realize that there are nuances that were hidden to you because you were consuming your information in such a slanted way.
Let's go to Tim next. Frank Bruni is our guest, New York Times columnist. Tim in Appleton. Hi, Tim.
Hello. I've been following this theater in Washington and the politics for well over 50 years, and I've noticed one thing in particular, and that is every new administration that comes in learns from the previous administration and does the same thing or the same kind of tricks. Now we've got this whole bunch of Washington insiders who know all the Washington insider tricks, and now we combine that with a businessman who knows all of the business, money, and banking tricks, and you combine those two, and I think we're in trouble.
You think we're in trouble, Frank?
I think we're in trouble, but I wouldn't define it the way the caller just did. Because to me, one of the interesting dynamics or observations about the Trump administration so far is that he actually has fewer political insiders, and they aren't as adept at playing the game as they might be. I mean, I think that was one of the morals lessons of the healthcare debacle. He wasn't consulting enough people or getting guidance from enough people who could really have painted an accurate portrait of the legislative landscape that he was facing, and maybe had a better idea of how to navigate it. So the political insider thing, if you're talking about the Trump administration itself, that's actually sort of been ratcheted down. He came into office with a sort of band of pirates from the campaign trail. It was really not a huge universe of people who advised him, and it was mostly people from outside the mainstream whom no one would call Steve Bannon a political insider. No one would call Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, a political insider. These, if anything, John McCain and Sarah Palin used to love the term maverick. It more accurately applies to these people. So political insideriness is not what I see as the biggest threat right now.
What is the biggest threat?
Well, I would say a bigger threat. I don't want to say what the biggest threat is, but I would say a bigger threat is just rank inexperience. When you look at the way Donald Trump has dealt with foreign leaders, when you look at the way he dealt with Congress in the debacle of trying to repeal and replace and not being able to repeal and replace Obamacare, you see his inexperience over and over again. Mm-hmm. That's a bigger threat. Arrogance is an enormous threat. To call a president arrogant is just to say there's oxygen in the atmosphere. You know, no man and someday woman will reach that office without without an overdose of arrogance. But I've met several presidents, and all of them are arrogant in particular ways. And Trump's arrogance is different from the arrogance of his predecessors. There's a recklessness to it. There's an unwillingness to listen to sound advice. That all concerns me much more than any sort of currency that political insiders have, because I think that currency has actually been diminished in the Trump administration.
Well, you look at one issue we'll talk about the second hour of our program today, the executive order that he signed yesterday that President Obama had spent a long time fashioning, this clean power plan, which is so tied into global warming and international agreements, and an issue that many say is the most important issue of our times, because it involves the survival of our planet. He just kind of cavalierly rolled back, saying, to the coal miners, well, we're going to get your jobs back, hiring people who really don't believe that carbon has much to do with global warming, carbon emissions. Some of this is pretty serious stuff, isn't it?
It's completely serious, and I think you used a great word right there, which is cavalier. Two things you said, I think everything you said was hugely important, but two things I want to return to. One is that word cavalier. I don't get the sense, when he's signing an executive order like that, when he's dealing with a foreign leader, that he has felt any obligation to inform himself. Mm. He made this casual comment either during or after Merkel's visit about how, well, Germany's had much better trade negotiators than we have, and they've gotten the better for us. And it seemed in that instant that he thought we traded, or that we forged trade agreements directly with Germany, when in fact there's this thing called the European Union that we deal with, that right. Germany's a part of. Right. I really feel like those sorts of enormous, enormous holes in his knowledge exist, and that he doesn't seem to do much work to fill them in. When people talk about his media diet and why he's saying certain things on certain days and reacting the way he is, the answer is usually, well, because he was watching either CNN or Fox News. Now, this is nothing against CNN or Fox News, but I would like to believe my president's daily diet of information and his regimen of becoming informed is not just glancing over his shoulder at CNN or Fox News. But I think that's what is happening with this president. It is cavalier. You said something else also. You mentioned, the coal miners, whatever. I think, and some people give him credit for this, because you should govern in a way that accurately reflects the way you campaigned. I think he is repaying favors, mm-hmm. And obliging certain constituencies that got him where he is. And you could say, you could really make the argument that is absolutely democracy at work, and why should we have any problem with that? Well, when it comes to some things like the environment, it represents the triumph of short-term expedient thinking over long-term thinking, and I think could have serious consequences down the road that he's not grappling with, again, because there's this sort of cavalierness, this shallowness, this desire to do what's convenient and good for him politically in the moment and not necessarily what represents responsible stewardship of the country.
Frank Bruni is our guest this hour, columnist for the New York Times. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Frank has also co-authored a book just released in February, and a way to bring people of all political persuasions together, because who doesn't love a really good meatloaf? And he has written a book on meatloafs, a meatloaf in every oven. And it includes recipes that he is fond of, his mom made her recipe, and some political recipes too, from Paul Ryan and Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, and somebody else. I can't forget. I can't remember who the other person was. Well, at any rate, it's got two Republicans and two Democrats with their, oh, Susan Collins, with their meatloaf recipes. But today he wrote about Nunez and his strange behavior about the House Intelligence Committee. The whole week kind of fell apart. They were supposed to hear from some witnesses about possible Russian connections with the Trump campaign, a serious investigation, but it hasn't gone anywhere because of Nunez this week, what he did. So join us in the remaining so many minutes that we have. Our number is 800-486-8655, and this is the Ideas Network. Okay, Frank Bruni is our guest now, and let's go to Kurt in Chippewa Falls next. Hi, Kurt.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Sure.
I would like to go back to the idea which is referred to so often, that there's so much dysfunction in Congress and in the country because Democrats and Republicans don't believe, distrust, hate each other, and never the twain shall meet. If I may speak of that briefly, and it's going to take a little while to lay it out if I have the time.
You have a little time, but not real long, Kurt, okay?
Okay. I'm 75 years old. I came of political age way back in the 60s, okay? I was conservative. The Vietnam War brought me around to a different way of thinking, but in any case, I'm old enough to remember quite precisely that through the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, people who were fashioning the Republican conservative mindset were demonizing Democrats and liberals in general as being a mental illness, that they were trying intentionally to lead the country into a socialistic state, yada, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
Talk radio, the right-wing talk radio, has a grip on its fandom, in which the people who listen to that, their personal identities are wrapped up in this refusal to consider. You don't see that on the liberal side.
All right, Kurt, I need to hold you there because I have so many other phone calls. Let's key in on the phrase about conservative radio and media. It is true that a lot of people get their information from people like Rush Limbaugh. What does that do to the national conversation, Frank?
Well, I mean, it polarizes it. It sends people, into these camps where people view their analogs on the other side of the aisle. They view them with a kind of suspicion and antipathy that is more intense and widespread than ever before. There's this one study that I don't have in front of me, but that I sometimes cite when I'm talking about this in public, where in 1960, if you asked Americans, would you be upset if your son or daughter married outside your political party? Like, the answer was something like 3% from one party, like maybe it was 3% of Republicans said they'd be upset and 5% of Democrats. The numbers were that low. When they asked the same question in 2010, 50 years later, the numbers were like 40% of Republicans and 37% of Democrats. But, I mean, we're talking by many, many multiples. People had come to view the other side, people on the other political party, not just as individuals they disagree with, but as individuals who were like in an enemy camp, who were trying to foist, you know, a bad way of living upon everyone. That's just a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for dysfunction. And we write every 2 years about how this Congress has either been the least or one of the least productive in the history of the institution. We've written that story repeatedly over the last decade. Well, the reason nothing can get done is because people don't see any room for compromise, because they regard each other as enemies, not as people working toward the same goals, but believing there are different paths to get to them.
Well, we're in rather unusual times. So factor in, Frank Bruni, the election of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not your normal president by any stretch of the imagination. And there are many who would say he's really fueled all of this antagonism, his response to questions in the press, his response to Muslims, his response to all kinds of things, has created a climate where, of course, what you just outlined is going to flourish.
You know, I think he's exacerbating it, but I have to say, and I write many, many tough things about Donald Trump, so I'm not trying to give him an out here in any way, shape, or form. I think he's more the fruit of these forces than he is the agent of these forces. He may be exacerbating and amplifying them, but he's in office because cynicism reached a certain point, because partisan reached a certain point, because our discourse had coarsened to a certain point. If you had told me a decade ago that someone who began his campaign very early on, sitting in front of TV cameras and besmirching John McCain and saying,
I
prefer people who weren't captured. John McCain's an American hero who spent years being tortured in a prison. And Donald Trump didn't just make light of that, he mocked it. This is like chapter one of his campaign, and on he rolled. If you then told me that something like the Access Hollywood Billy Bush tape would come out, and it would not stop him from rolling on, I would have said that's impossible. Something has happened in terms of our cynicism and in terms of the coarseness of our discourse that Donald Trump reflects very, very vividly. But to say he's the cause of it, I think, is wrong, because he would not be where he is if he wasn't coming along at a moment that was ripe for someone just like him.
Very interesting. Thanks, Kurt, for your call. Casey in Rice Lake. Hi, Casey.
Hello.
Hi.
I am calling about meatloaf.
Okay.
Oh, my gosh. My mom was the best cook, but she made the worst meatloaf.
Oh, no.
Oh, when I was a kid and there was meatloaf. Oh, please. No. But I've been redeemed because of a community cookbook. Someone had a meatloaf recipe with the bomb horseradish.
Ah.
I love meatloaf now if you have horseradish in it.
Ooh, do any of your recipes have that ingredient, Frank?
I think a few of them do, and some of them have other things that serve that sort of sparky function. You know, some of them have hot mustard in them. We have a couple with sriracha in them. So the idea that you can enliven your meatloaf with some zippy spices or zippy effects like horseradish, that's a very, very worthy idea. And yeah, no, we have a lot of if you want to cook your way through our book, you need a pretty comprehensive spice cabinet. And a great number of condiments in your refrigerator.
Thanks, Casey, for your suggestion. Kenneth in Janesville, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Kenneth.
Back to the meatloaf. But what both of you missed is that this was a piece de resistance, I mean the health care bill. My neighbor, Mr. Paul Ryan, I mean, this is what he worked on for 7 years, this great herder of cats. And he came up with a meatloaf made from cats. And nobody liked it.
Listen, I think it's we can say many, many negative things on this show, but I think comparing meatloaf to the health care bill is really hitting below the belt. I cannot endorse that. listen, Paul Ryan had if you were asking who had the worst week in Washington, it's very arguable it was Paul Ryan and not Donald Trump, because Paul Ryan has assiduously fashioned a reputation for himself as this erudite policy wonk. And if you actually look at the record, there's not a lot of wonky policy that anyone can attribute to him, certainly not that's become law. Now, he was working for years occurs under a Democratic president, Obama. And so there was a built-in, hey, I can't get anything done because the president, you know, would never, ever sign that legislation and, you know, ratify what I'm doing. Well, here he had a president who more or less outsourced the repeal and replace of Obamacare to Paul Ryan. Mm-hmm. Paul Ryan went out there and said, I have worked on this plan. I love this plan. I endorse this plan. Let me educate you on the wonders of this plan. And his own Republican caucus could not be convinced of the wonders of it. So I think Paul Ryan right now is immersed in a kind of identity crisis that few of us want to have professionally or personally in our lifetimes.
Frank, thank you so much for being with us. It was a wonderful hour. And thanks for writing the book on Meatloaf and for taking on so many topics. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's always an incredible pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks. Thanks, Frank. Frank Bruni, our guest. He's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. Today, his piece is on Devin Nunes, or Nunes, whichever one it is. It's well worth your attention. And we also talked about safety on college campuses. And, of course, a meatloaf in every oven. And we're going to try and find that. Look on our Facebook page a little bit later. We'll find that Donald Trump, Melania Trump appearance on Martha Stewart, which is well worth seeing, Frank said. So we'll find that and post it. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing our and Kevin Duvall for on-air production here in Milwaukee.